Good evening, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Perceptive Podcast here on Game Wisdom, where we examine the art and science of games. I am Josh Weiser, and we got a great cast for you this evening. First off, joining me is contributor to Game Wisdom and co-host for the cast, James Ellerby.
Hey, how you guys doing? I'm the intern.
And our guest this week, he is from the studio Level Up Labs. They are the makers behind Defender's Quest and working on the sequel to that. He's here to talk about the studio, as well as a topic that has been certainly getting some note in recent years for indie developers, and that is the issue of key reselling. Please welcome Lars Doucet.
Hey, everybody.
Hey, Lars. It's great to have you on the cast today.
Thank you.
So, there's definitely a lot to talk about tonight, but to get things started with, for people who haven't heard of Level Up Labs or Defender's Quest, Lars, could you tell us a little bit about yourself and your studio?
Okay, so not much super interesting about my studio. It's just, you know, handful of people making some indie games. My game is called Defender's Quest. It's been out for about 4 years, and it's probably elevator pitch is it's a combination of tower defense and RPG. So imagine your standard, you know, JRPG style melodrama and colorful cast of characters. And then instead of the regular battle system, you have tower defense. But instead of towers, you have every individual quote unquote tower is a unique character in your party who can level up, get their own skills, have their own equipment, and kind of customize them. So it's a lot more hands-on than your typical tower defense, and it has long-term progression as well as kind of in-battle progression, and that's kind of what makes the game unique.
And then
I write a bunch of articles on Gamma Sutra in my own blog a lot that some people know me by that instead of my actual games. So
yeah, and Defender's Quest has definitely been it's been generally well received. I've seen a lot of people love it. I really enjoy the game when I played it. I think I played maybe like a year or 2 years ago, if I remember right.
Yeah, and it's interesting because it's been really interesting journey because it used to be you would release a game and then you're done, you know, and you need to move on to the next one like as quickly as possible. What's actually happened with Defender's Quest is we found, you know, it's been really, really well received. I mean, this might only be something you can do if the game's really well received. You know, it's not like Minecraft or anything, but, you know, we've sold a bunch of copies. I think about 250,000 last I checked. That's spread out over 4 years, of course.
Yeah.
And so we figured it's like, okay, we're working on this sequel, but we need to have money continuously coming in. So it's worth it to keep updating the original game, you know, because it, you know, if I put 1 month of extra work on the original game, you know, not only does that contribute to the sequel because they share the same engine, but that makes people that much more willing to buy the original game, which they're still buying. And I can release, you know, a patch in a week or a month rather than, okay, see you guys in, you know, a year, 2 years when the next thing's out. And so it's been a very interesting model where you can continuously update something and keep people interested in it. And this is for a single player title, which, you know, you'd expect that only for multiplayer or free to play or, you know, super procedural games. But at least in our case, it works. I'm not sure exactly why that is, but it does.
It's definitely a very interesting time for game development, especially for indie developers. And the issue of constantly supporting a title has definitely become a debatable part for studios. As you just said, Lars, it's something that really, I think, hasn't taken root until at least maybe 5-6 years ago, especially with the rise of the indie side of things. And again, like back in my day, I get to say that I'm feeling really old again. Back in my day, as you just said, Lars, you release a game, that's it. It's done. You may release like a little compatibility patch or fix some bugs, but that game is done. You're not going to be working on a game post-release. And then with stuff like the Minecraft model, early access, and even with like Kickstarter and crowdfunding, developers are definitely seeing, with certain titles, the advantages of constantly supporting a game. And I've spoken to several indie developers who've also been doing that. Stuff like Clay Entertainment with Don't Starve and Invisible Inc. Arkane Games, pretty much their MO has been post-release support with stuff like AI Wars. And we're even starting to see that with AAA developers. I'm trying to think of some quick examples off my head, but stuff like Call of Duty, even like recently XCOM 2, Mortal Kombat, etc., etc. These are games where they'll have support for months, maybe even for an entire year after release. And
Yeah, and I think there's two forces that made this go from something that never happened to something that did happen.
Mm-hmm.
And that is that back in the battle days of game development, first of all, there was no digital distribution. Mm-hmm. I think that's pretty self-explanatory. People understand that. You know, now it's actually possible to put out a patch.
Definitely.
You know, and everybody get it. So, you know, now that can be done. But also there's an incentive to do it now, because one of the biggest kind of shifts, I think, is that, you know, on Steam or GOG or any of these digital distribution places, if you self-publish, you get to keep like most of the revenue to your game.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it used to be under a lot of the old publishing deals, like you would get zero royalties. You know, I mean, there's still plenty of deals like that, especially in AAA, where, you know, someone else is funding your whole game. It's like, okay, here's your money, now make it, and you get to keep what's left. And, you know, your job, your reward is you get to be employed for 2 years of development, you know, and then we take all the profit. Mm-hmm. So for those developers who are able to self-publish or who are able to negotiate better deals, it's like, hey, if we update it, we'll get more money, mm-hmm. as opposed to we'll get zero money. So time to move on to something else.
Yeah.
And so I think those two forces have a lot to do with it.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Digital distribution has definitely been just a linchpin for so many changes and so many, like, improvements, I think, to the game industry and game development over the last, I guess it's been about maybe 9 or 10 years since it really took root, especially as you said with Steam, now with GOG, and even with just like consoles these days are getting it too, with a lot of virtual games, PSN, XBLA, etc., etc.
Yeah,
and it really, I think, has done so much good for developers. I mean, chances are we probably wouldn't be sitting here talking if it wasn't for Steam and just making it viable for indies to not only self-publish, but again, to control the majority of their revenue and control their games. I think the patching is another really big point. Again, back in the day, it was very hard to get these patches for games. You had to hunt down the developer for it. And just the accessibility that Steam has provided for developers and consumers has just really changed the scape of the game industry.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I know we're going to be talking more about the industry side of things later on this cast, especially with the key reselling and G2A issue. But before we get to that, I definitely want to touch a little bit more on Defender's Quest 1 and number 2.
Okay.
So with the first game, one thing I just want to ask you, again, I played this, I think it was about a year or so ago, if I remember right.
Mm-hmm.
How have you been actually supporting the game? Like, for developers listening to this cast who may be taking notes, like, what was your, like, game plan to keep Defender's Quest relevant and in the consumer eye?
Well, first of all, one of the kind of foundational principles of why I kept supporting it was, mm-hmm. it's, first of all, it's not a free-to-play game. It's not a procedural game.
Mm-hmm.
It's a single-player game with, you know, a set amount of content, you know. But it's a lot. You know, you can play that game for, I've seen people clock 200 hours in it, mm-hmm. which is crazy, but they've done it. So my assumption had always been, you know, for a game that's this highly rated, I have yet to reach its full potential audience. I wrote an article a couple weeks ago about bottlenecks. I'll send you the link to it.
Yeah.
But basically talks about, we have not reached its full potential audience. So I'm interested in how can I make this game appealing to even more players, you know, because it's kind of spreading by word of mouth, but they come and they bounce off it. So find what is a flaw someone's complaining about and fix it. And then another flaw comes up and fix it, you know? So obviously do good customer service to retain the players I already have, but also kind of have an eye towards, you know, reaching out to new people. So for instance, one of the first things I did was like, okay, well, let's add some mod support, you know, let's add Steam Cloud support, you know, that just kind of basic stuff. Add those little features people want to see. you know, so that we can tick those boxes. And I mean, that didn't take super long. And then that got some more people interested in it. Then I was like, okay, well, what's the next thing that's limiting people from playing it? Well, I bet people can't play it if, you know, they speak German and they don't understand English too well. So we started doing a bunch of localizations, and we've seen increase in that. That's a modest gain, but it's a thing you can do. And then I, you know, and then stuff like that steadily and steadily. The big, big change we did is, of course, the DX or Deluxe update, which we just released. And this is a bit of a special case. I wouldn't recommend this for just any regular developer. But this is where basically we put out a whole new game engine for the game that now supports HD graphics, full resolution, modern 60 FPS unlocked frame rate, and all new high resolution graphics and art for everything instead of the old sprite art. But you can use the old art if you want. And so I wouldn't necessarily recommend to someone go ahead and release a free HD update for your game. Our special case was we're working on Defender's Quest 2, so we're working on an improved engine. Well, that engine's basically done now. So I thought to myself, you know, I'm testing this with the original game's data set already. And that's basically, you know, that's a product we could ship just as a thank you to all our fans and to show that, you know, we haven't been doing nothing, you know, this whole time. So we just decided to go ahead and update that. And now my four-year-old game has a fresh coat of paint. It doesn't look so long in the tooth. You know, I feel a little less embarrassed, you know, going out and aggressively shoving it in people's faces and telling them they should play this because it doesn't look like it was developed, you know, 4 years ago. And so, and we've definitely seen an uptick in sales. Total Biscuit got interested in it and did a video on it. You know, none of that would have happened without the update.
Yeah. And it is definitely interesting about doing an update of that magnitude on a game. Again, as you said, Lars, Defender's Quest is a single player game. And I think I would agree with you. It's definitely not something that most developers would probably have the chance to do, but it definitely sounds like it worked in your case. And again, you had the, I guess you had the luxury of the fact that you're basically killing two birds with one stone. You also are basically taking what you've learned with the engine in Defender's Quest 1 and applying some of that to Defender's Quest 2.
Right. Yeah. If we weren't, if we, I can say pretty definitively, if we had not been working towards Defender's Quest 2 and been working on a new engine anyway, we probably wouldn't have done the Deluxe update. It just was a natural outgrowth of that work.
Yeah, and it's kind of crazy these days to hear like all the ways developers are extending their games. As you said, with the Deluxe edition, like a complete engine overhaul is definitely something that not a lot of developers will have access to, but we're seeing cases where developers will add in brand new systems, brand new modes. Recently, I spoke with Troy Goodfellow, who works with Paradox Interactive, and Paradox really has taken the post-game support to like insane levels with their 4X games, Europa Universalis, and stuff like that. And I wrote a post, I think, about this a while ago, about the pros and cons of this kind of long-term support. And as you said, Lars, one of the big key advantages of it is that it keeps people invested in your game. It keeps people talking about it. But of course, there is the downside. In some cases, if you take your game too far away from the original concept, if you make too many changes to it, you may lose those fans. And I think
that's what they call the George Lucas effect.
Yes. Uh-huh. And I think with Defender's Quest, I think you definitely did a good job of preserving your fan base while growing it. One thing that I also want to touch on just briefly was the topic of localization, because this is something, again, that I think most consumers don't really think too much about. But it is something, again, that adds accessibility to your game, especially today with the fact that, again, thanks to digital distribution, you're no longer just keeping to an audience that's local. You're talking to people from around the world. As just a general, you don't have to go too far into the detail, was it a hard process localizing your game to other languages?
It's not anymore. I will say that I would say it was hard. It was not easy. I had to learn a lot of things. And that is because I knew nothing and because I did it after the fact, like after I'd written my whole game. It just had all kinds of text just hard coded right into the game engine, you know. Print, hello, you got 5 plus number plus apples. You know what I mean? So, like, I was doing all these terrible worst practices. So if you know what you're doing and you do your homework before you start your game or before your game's too far along and you just build it in from the beginning, it's actually not very hard. And it's actually surprisingly easy in a lot of ways. You just have to kind of be educated about what all the pitfalls are. You have to know how Unicode works. Mm-hmm. You have to know really deep down what your game engine is capable of when it comes to displaying text. You need to know about file encodings. You need to know about fonts. And each of those things like sounds really scary, but like you don't have to know Japanese to localize your game to Japanese. You obviously need a localizer, a translator who speaks Japanese, and maybe a friend who speaks Japanese to like spot check the work for them, so you're not just taking on faith. But the actual technical side of it is not too complicated. So that to answer your question of was it hard? It was at first because I knew nothing.
Okay.
But now that I know everything and I've actually crystallized a lot of my knowledge now and released it as open source libraries that other people can use in their games to simplify the process for them and provide them some instructions on how to localize things correctly and easily.
Cool. And I know like with certain development houses, the concept of localizing is a big deal. Like I follow Atlas a lot. And of course, Atlas has both the branch in Japan and the North American branch. I know that their localization is considered, I think, one like the top tier, at least for like console developers. But it is definitely a topic that I don't think a lot of people talk about, much less like enthusiasts or students would know about. So I just wanted to bring it up. Now let's move on. Before we go into our big topic then, I just want to touch a little bit on Defender's Quest 2, because I know you guys have been working on this for a while now.
Yeah.
For people listening to this cast then, how is Defender's Quest 2 going?
It's gone well, you know. So it's a much more ambitious game, you know, hence the new engine.
Yeah.
And so one thing I've been very kind of careful about with it is I don't want to wind up like a lot of these other crowdfunded projects, because we did have a pre-order campaign for it. And it's still going, actually, because it's not Kickstarter. We just have a pre-order page up, you know, and people occasionally pre-order it. So I wanted to make sure we didn't do the classic thing where you burn your whole budget and then you have to like ask for all this more money. The plan was always to use residual ongoing sales of DQ1 plus DQ2 pre-orders to fund it. And pursuant to that, we decided to do all the unglamorous, but not necessarily money out of pocket expensive stuff first. And save the expensive stuff that you have to basically contract out. Usually the most expensive stuff is programming, but I'm doing the programming and I can just, you know, enslave myself until it's done. And you know, DQ1 takes care of keeping me paid. And then, so basically our biggest single cost is art. Which is interesting because that is the number one most visible sign of your progress is just a bunch of art you post, you know, to the degree that a lot of these crowdfunded projects will just post a bunch of mockups and screenshots and give people the illusion that they're almost done when they haven't even started or don't even have an engine. And so anyway, to get back to the point, how far along are we? Well, we're done with the engine. As far, you know, we'll add some more features, maybe a subsystem or two, you know, but the DQ2 engine, which DQDX is using, is already capable of a bunch of stuff that you won't see in the original in DQ1. You'll only see it in DQ2. It's just kind of hiding there in the code. In terms of story, we've gone through like five or six different story drafts, and I'm so glad we have, because if we just went with our first one, we'd have to like redo a bunch of stuff, which means throwing a lot of art away and even programming systems and stuff. So being able to work really closely with my writer, who's the same writer from the first game, and take that time that's necessary to get it right makes us more confident that we're not gonna churn and throw and waste effort. In terms of art, we've spent a long time like finding the right art partners, and they're great and they're reliable. We posted some of their stuff already. We'll be posting more soon. So that's the phase we're gonna save for basically last. Once everything's kind of white boxed and working, we'll then push the button on art to fill everything in. And then in terms of audio, we're working with the same musician from before, Kevin Penkin. And also, as kind of a coincidence, he had collaborated with the Final Fantasy musician, Nobuo Uematsu, before. And so, you know, a little while ago, I told him, hey, Kevin, can you just, you know, ask him? He's like, sure, I'll go ask him if, you know, he wants to work with you guys. And it took a lot of negotiations and back and forth, but we finally did get him to agree to work on the game with us. And so he's given us He's working with Kevin in that. So Kevin's kind of his apprentice, and he's kind of, you know, he's like, here's these songs I want to do. And then Kevin will, you know, I think the term is arrangement. But anyway, so we've got a couple of his tracks. We've got several that we haven't shown yet, and we'll be posting those in the next couple months. But, that's been very exciting. So it's pretty far along. The hardest part, the engine is done, and now we're working on the content and stuff like that. And we're going to be showing more of that, in the coming months.
Cool. Do you have any like concrete like time frames for like, are you going to do like an early access with Defender's Quest 2, or are you just going to go like straight to release when that time comes?
We'll do closed alpha and beta.
Okay.
Those are some of our pre-order tiers, and also testing volunteers who put in, you know, a valuable amount of testing time. That's just as good as money to us. Mm-hmm. So we'll give select trustworthy testers early access too.
All right. Is there any idea or any rough idea when the game will be done, or is it still pretty much up in the air at the moment?
I've learned the hard way to not set hard release dates, because everything always takes longer. Mm-hmm. So what I do is, on my website, I have a little tracker up, which is just objectively feature based. Here's everything left that needs to be done. And it's tied to my GitHub issue tracker. Mm-hmm. So every time I finish something, it hits a webhook, and on my website the next day, it fills up the progress bar a little more. Cool. And so that's the closest we have.
All right. Yeah, I know. That's one of the things I've definitely learned with talking to developers the last few years. Never want to give a hard deadline for some of these designs.
Mm-hmm.
Before we move on from Defender's Quest 2 to our main topic, in terms of the actual design or mechanics, is there anything like new or different with Defender's Quest 2 that you can talk about at the moment?
Yes, there's a lot of stuff that's going to be different. So. Okay. The original Defender's Quest, you know, we were doing this kind of innovative thing in merging RPG and tower defense in a way that hadn't really been done before. I think it's been done since, mm-hmm. But it hadn't really been done the way we did it at the time that I'm aware of.
Yeah.
And so because we were taking that kind of big risk, we were intentionally very conservative in the rest of the design. You know, our writer had the restriction. It's like, you can be creative and like, you know, kind of go outside the box and stuff, but it's got to be stock fantasy. Mm-hmm. You know, it's got to be, you know, medieval magic and swords. Mm-hmm. You know, so work within that box. And then in terms of mechanics, you know, we didn't go really super far out for the whole original game. You don't even have items with special stats. We added that later in New Game Plus.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so in the second game, we're much more confident to take risks. So the biggest change is that we're doing away with an army that's mostly filled out with generic units. You know, you had your six heroes, but you could have up to 24, I think, I think you could have up to 30 generic units. And so in the new game, every human character in your party is a unique hero with their own unique skill tree, their own unique stats and everything. This was actually based off of a fan created a self-imposed limitation called hero mode, where you only play with heroes. Mm-hmm. And it's a lot more interesting to me than the regular mode, because you can't just spam whatever the most OP class is. You know, you have to make trade-offs, and it makes every map play really differently. Of course, the original game, because it was not originally intended as a specific thing, it's a hardcore challenge mode. So we're going to build the second game kind of around that model, but with more characters. Mm-hmm. And that's the biggest change. The other one is that we're going to be doing a lot more stuff with, equipment that matters, that helps your loadout, you know, a much bigger focus on loadout and placement and skills, so that your customization matters a lot more than in the original game, so that there's a lot more room for different play styles. That'll probably be the biggest difference. Also, the map will be bigger. Mm-hmm. And user interface will be streamlined and improved with all the feedback from the original game. I think those are all the things that we can go ahead and say right now that are definitely going to be different.
Awesome. And I want to also elaborate on one point you just said, Lars, regarding limiting yourself with the first game by the fact that you were still building and experimenting with the design to then sort of let loose with Defender's Quest 2 in terms of new mechanics and new systems there. That's another thing that I hear from a lot of indie developers, and one thing we've talked about, I think, a long time ago on the cast, regarding making sure when you're building the game not to go too far out of the box. At the same time, you're basically building things from scratch. Because it's very tempting to, you know, go, you know, balls to the wall. We're just going to put everything we want into our first game and not necessarily see, you know, what works, what doesn't, stuff like that. And it is smart design to limit yourself in a way, especially when you're building something that has never been before seen. Lately, I spoke with Adrian Jensen from Abbey Games, who did Renown Explorers, which was one of my favorite games. It was my favorite game of 2015. And he talked about how they just, you know, had, it was a great game, but it really killed them trying to make that game because they were building this insanely unique game with multiple systems. They pretty much went, you know, to the extreme end for their first title.
Mm-hmm.
But when it comes to design, especially with AAA developers, we really see that the first game in a series is usually the foundation or the test. It's to make sure that this mechanic or these systems can work, and then the sequel is usually greatly expanded upon. Mm-hmm. And I know, as a developer, that's pretty much you're just saying, duh, to that you know that. But for enthusiasts and students listening, that is an important lesson, especially if you're trying to build your own game for the first time.
It's. I mean, that's why Mega Man 2 is the classic game that everybody loves.
Yeah.
And Mega Man 1 is kind of rough around the edges. Mm-hmm. Is you spend your whole time making an engine, and then you add some content, and you have no idea how it's going to be received. I mean, you can get early feedback, but you know what I mean. You haven't released it yet, and so I feel like there's a trend a lot for the second game to actually be the best in the series.
Yeah, and a really good example of that would be like Assassin's Creed 2. The jump from 1 to 2 is just phenomenal, and hell, Just Cause 1 to 2. Number 2 is one of my favorite games.
Right.
Yep, and I mean, we could spend a whole lot of time talking about that, but I know you have to get going in about like 30 minutes or so, so let's move on to our big topic, and this is the one that sort of been brought to my attention lately, and that has been the growing issue of key reselling, and what it means for indie developers, and just for the PC market in general. Now, what started this, what happened, I think, by the time you're hearing this cast, for those of you listening, I think it happened about 3 weeks ago, maybe four, just thereabout, and it had to do with the indie publisher Tiny Build, I believe. I think that's their name.
Mm-hmm.
And they basically made a post regarding the key reseller G2A, which has really risen in popularity over recent years. They quote unquote support YouTubers. I know I see their advertisements a lot on Twitch streams. And Tiny Build reported that due to lost sales and key resellers who went through G2A, I think they lost like, I think it was like $450,000 or something like that in terms of potential profits with their games. Now, the concept of key reselling is definitely something that I know a lot of younger gamers or people recently in the game industry may not be aware of. I know when I ask you about this, James, as someone who's been strictly to console gaming, it's definitely a new concept for you.
Yeah, key reselling doesn't really happen in the console market as much.
So. Yeah. So for you, Lars, if you wouldn't mind, for people listening to this cast who are like James, or who are relatively new to PC gaming and may not know what this issue is or how big of a deal it is, could you sort of give us, like, I guess the Cliff's Notes version of what's going on?
Yeah, sure. And I want to circle back to Tiny Build specifically because I have some interesting things to say about them. Mm-hmm. But first of all, so the basic concept of key reselling is, so a game developer, when you sell your game on Steam, you have the ability basically to print an unlimited number of Steam keys.
Mm-hmm.
And a Steam key basically is a 100% off coupon for your game. You know, redeem for one free copy of your game. You go into Steam, you plug in the code, you get the game. Usually these are used for press, obviously. You know, if you want Total Biscuit to cover your game, you're not going to send him an email, say, please buy my game for $14.99 so that you can give me coverage. You know, he's, you know, he ain't got time for that. And same with all your other developers. I mean, this is super old. Back in the day, you would send them a disk. Now you send them a Steam key.
Yep. And just as a quick aside for people listening, I, of course, as someone who's now considered press, I do get press copies for a lot of the games that I've been covering here.
Right. But, yeah. And so, anyway, so what key reselling is key reselling can, of course, be legitimate. So, for instance, I am a key reseller of my own games. Steam will allow you to print off a run of Steam keys mm-hmm. and then sell them on other sites. So, for instance, you can buy Defender's Quest from my website at defendersquest.com instead of from Steam. And why would you do that? Well, the answer is because I get to keep more of the money because I can just use the Humble widget, which takes a smaller percent than Steam. And Steam is still happy to let me just sell that key. So Steam doesn't see any profit off of that key sold. But I think the reason they let you do this is because it makes it so that no matter where you buy the game from, you are still signing up for Steam, which is why they add like a million users a year. So they're playing the long game. But anyway, so, but like if you buy it from me, you can get a DRM free copy and a Steam key, et cetera. So, so some people will opt to do that. And then, you know, I'll work with like a, you know, we localize our game into Japanese. And so there's like this little Japanese, regional distributor who's like, hey, can you give some Steam keys to resell? Because that's what everyone wants to buy. So we have a specialty Japanese store that only sells copies in Japan, and I'll give them, you know, a small run of keys. And same with other stores. And then if you like work with someone like chrono.gg or Humble Bundle or any of those promotional sites, which can offer you some good deals, you know, if you like the terms, you know, what they will be selling is Steam keys. So, key reselling, specifically in this context with G2A, is what we call gray market key reselling. And this is when a third-party store that's not authorized by the developer gets a hold of the keys somehow and then resells them to end users. And I'm going to take what might be a controversial stance here, is that I actually don't necessarily mind what I call legitimate gray market key reselling. And I'll give you an example. So, let's say I go on, you know, my little regional Japanese store or, Humble Bundle or even, you know, my own website, you know, people can perhaps I go on a 50% off sale and they buy 1,000 copies of Defender's Quest at 50% off. And then they go and set up their own site and they put up those keys for sale and they sell them for 40% off after my discount has ended. Well, now they're making a margin of 10% off of every sale. And so some developers get upset about this first form of gray market key reselling, which is just arbitrage. So they don't like it because it's like, okay, so when my discount ends, someone can undercut me and now I'm losing sales. I don't mind this so much. I see it the same as like being an author and someone buys a used copy of your book. Back in the day, a lot of game developers really hated the idea of trade-ins and used sale. I'm actually always been this is just me. I speak for myself and no one else. I've always been a strong proponent of the right of first sale because it's one of the things that makes people willing to spend more money in the first place. And I think it's a fundamental right. If this is just me, I'm not going to judge anyone else for disagreeing. And also, you know, I got paid for that copy and it's my choice to run that discount. So if someone undercuts me, you know, it's kind of my own fault. So, I don't really mind that so much. And it's kind of, I put it in a similar category to like worrying too much about piracy, you know, on which I've spoken about at length and won't go into here. You know, I just rather focus on customers who actually want to pay me money. So I don't mind too much the key resellers who just do arbitrage because they're putting their own money at risk and they're making, you know, they're only making the margins I'll let them make by choosing what discounts I want to run. And I get paid anyway. On the first sale. Some people really hate that, and that's up to them to hate that, and they'll tell you why. But what really gets my bee in a bonnet is companies specifically like G2A. They're the only one I'll mention by name because they're the only ones I'm sure are doing this. I'm sure that others are doing it too, but not enough to name them by name. So this is what I call the dark side of gray market reselling. And the problem with this is not so much arbitrage, lost, quote unquote, hypothetical sales. It's actual money out of developers' pockets. It's actual theft. It's actual fraud. And the way the scam works is, you know, there's some, and Tiny Build's a good example here. So I will ding them on their $450,000 remark, because mm-hmm. what they did there is basically just take the full retail price and multiply it by the number of keys, which is a little disingenuous because nobody ever sells at full price on average.
Yeah.
You know, like my game sells for $14.99. I think the average price when you include every Steam sale and bundle is like, you know, maybe I sell at an average of $5 or less. So I think that's a little disingenuous of them. But, you know, I would have rather they just said this many keys were lost.
Yeah.
So, but anyway, back to G2A. So the way the scam works, G2A goes on a third-party sale. Tiny Build was running their own store, and you could buy keys from them. And so they would buy up a bunch of the keys. Now, actually, G2A wasn't doing this, actually. What was doing it was just regular criminals. They would steal credit cards, which you can get on the dark web for really cheap. They would buy stolen credit cards. Then they would just go and buy as many keys as they could, often using scripts. And so, like, in an hour, you can just, like that, rack up a whole bunch of transactions. It's like, okay, well, you know, it's stolen credit card. Tiny Build's still getting paid, right? You know, well, what happens is the owners of those credit cards see, like, what are all these purchases from tinybuild.com? WTF is this? And they issue a chargeback. So the credit card company's like, oh, that's obviously fraud. Your card was stolen. We're going to cancel that transaction. So Tiny Build, you know, they would get, like, I don't know, thousands of dollars of income that they thought they had. And suddenly that income goes poof. So that can really kill you if the gap between when you get that money and when it's taken away is like, oh, I have all this money. I'm going to spend it on paying my employees. Oh, now it's taken out of my account and I have negative money. So first of all, that's bad. Even if you net nothing on it, that's bad. But on top of that, you get hit with fees. You, as the seller, have to absorb the chargeback fee. The credit card company's like, look, these people committed fraud against you. I'm giving them their money back, and I'm going to fine you. Because that's just the way it's set up. I'm sure there's a reason for that. But the bottom line is you lose the sales, you lose the merchandise, and you have to pay for the privilege of selling your stuff to criminals who you don't get even paid for. So you wind up not at net zero, but like net a large negative number of fee times the number of keys that were stolen. And then what they do is they go on G2A and they just dump all the keys on the market because it's like eBay. It's just basically a digital pawn shop that doesn't check ID. And so, you know, if you go into a pawn shop with 100 Xboxes, you know, if that was my pawn shop, I'd be like, hey, buddy, where did you get those? Something tells me that you didn't just have 100 Xboxes you weren't using anymore. I think you stole them, you know, but anyway, maybe you check ID and you find out, oh, he used to own a store that went out of business. Okay, that's fine. But anyway, so they'll go and unload all these keys on sites like G2A, and then regular customers will buy them. And so what happens then is they didn't put their own money at risk. They bought them with stolen credit cards, so they are making pure profit. Like, they can sell them for a dollar, 30 cents, whatever, and they want to sell them quick, so they put them up for cheap. So now it's, okay, now I have a legitimate reason to be upset that they're undercutting you on price, because it's not just, you know, first sale arbitrage where they risk their own money and it's your own fault for going on discount. You know, now it's like, okay, so now my own stolen goods are competing with me. My own stolen goods are costing me money directly, not just in terms of me having less money than I thought, but actually costing me money in fees. But now it's even competing with my own product, and people would rather buy here than from me. It's just every kind of awful.
Yeah.
And it's got several victims in it. It's got, you know, because this creates a market, it's kind of like gold farming and WoW. It's like it creates this whole ecosystem, you know, and so there's victims from the developer, from the people who are getting their card stolen. Like, as long as they can run this little loop and set their little bots to just push the make money button, it'll just continue to escalate until brakes are put on it or the system is broken. So, like, I mean, there's so many other things that are bad about this, but that in a nutshell is how it works and how the scam works and why it's bad.
And definitely definitely fascinating. Thank you for going into detail about that, Laura, because I'm sure a lot of people aren't aware what is happening with these kind of resale. And the issue of first sale doctrine and if it's all right to sell keys, that is something I would love to get into with you more, but I'm sure that is a podcast in of itself, because I know that is something that there's been a lot of discussions regarding that, especially with how international law works. But yeah, I don't want to talk too much about that now because we'll be here for another hour.
But I'll just say that, you know, a Steam key can only be redeemed once, so it's even less of a quote-unquote threat than a used book, which can be sold a million times.
Yeah. But with the issue of key reselling, again, it's something that it's definitely been growing more in popularity. As you were saying a few minutes ago, with the options of things to like Humble Bundle, putting out press copies, and of course, with the darknet and being able to sell credit cards, it's becoming more and more viable. Now, with G2A, I was looking at some of the things that Tiny Bill was talking about. I think you may have mentioned this too, is the fact that they also, that it kind of seems like they're aware of this. They have their own, like, quote-unquote insurance program for consumers. I think it's called their G2A Shield. Is that it?
Yeah, and this is kind of like what really strikes me as basically an admission of guilt on G2A's part, where they know that some portion of the keys are stolen. Now, some people have fired back at me defending G2A. It's like, you're saying the majority of the keys are stolen. It's like, no, I'm not saying the majority of the keys. It doesn't have to be a majority. It doesn't even have to be, you know, like a large percentage. Like even just like 5% is an outrageous amount of fraud.
Yeah.
You know, and but anyway, G2A Shield is an acknowledgement by G2A that you might buy a stolen key. So they know it's a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And if you buy a stolen key, if you tack on like an extra dollar or whatever, they will insure the purchase and replace it if it doesn't work, presumably because it's stolen and the key was canceled. So what I argue in my article, G2A Piracy in the Four Currencies, is that I argue that, hey, if you're thinking of buying from G2A, I would rather you just pirate my game because you're not costing me money in chargeback fees. And it's a better deal for you because you're not getting scammed by G2A.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, I don't like piracy, but it's objectively better than this. And so the G2A Shield program, basically, what I find most offensive about it is that basically they're offloading the cost of fraud to their customers. Like I mentioned before, if a developer sells something and it's, you know, bought with a stolen credit card, you get hit with a chargeback. And now that I think about it, it's like the reason for that is that they want to make an extreme disincentive for you to accept stolen credit card payments. I think if you can figure out that it was fraudulent within a certain window, you don't have to pay a fee. And so certain stores are really good at this. Humble is really good at this. Tiny Build's little store obviously was not. And so G2A is like, you know, instead of the customer, instead of us absorbing the cost of fraud, which is what all other reputable stores have to do, Humble absorbs the cost of fraud. Steam absorbs the cost of fraud. I absorb the cost of fraud. They're like, hey, you customer, you get to pay for the cost of fraud. You know, it's not something we're going to roll into our own business. It's like, you need to pay it to us because we're going to find even more ways to get more money out of you.
Yeah, and that was the thing when I was looking up. I think, as you just said, Lars, that really sort of signifies that they know it's a problem, but they're doing, you know, like the most half-assed way of getting around it. And again, if they were trying to be reputable, as you said, they would look at more stringent ways of protecting or verifying these keys. But,
and even more low-hanging fruit is just, you know, go after the fraudulent sellers. You know, people say it's like, okay, G2A isn't stealing the credit cards. G2A isn't stealing the keys. They disconnect buyers. It's not their fault. There will always be thieves. And I'm like, the biggest problem with that, and there's, you know, links in the article and stuff other people have said, is that the fraud has gotten worse in the last year. As, you know, nature abhors a vacuum, the market abhors an arbitrage opportunity. If people can find a way to make a bot make money, they're going to push the make money button and it's going to rip into escalation.
Yeah.
So for instance, the lowest hanging fruit they can do is just, what was his name? Level Cap Gaming, he's a YouTuber, did a video called G2A Den of Thieves, and he showed some research where he goes on to G2A and he finds users who have hundreds or thousands of negative feedbacks because they've sold broken keys, which means they're presumably stolen and canceled. Yeah. And they're still top rated. Like, are you kidding me? And then people would write back to me when I pointed this out and defend G2A. They're like, well, he still has 97% positive. And I'm like, have you ever bought something from a 97% positive rated eBay seller? You get like a box of soap instead of an iPhone. You know, it's like there is a massive logarithmic scale between 97% not fraud and 99.5, 99.9% no fraud.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, it's like, because at the volume they're doing, you know, it's like, and we don't know how much of the fraud is not captured or reported. We don't know how many people just had G2A Shield and didn't mind that their key was stolen and therefore didn't report it.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know how many people didn't report their credit card stolen. We don't know how many people check their monthly statements. You know, yeah. We don't know how many developers are just so kind of babes in the woods about this that they didn't notice the fraud until it was way too late. So I feel like whatever amount of fraud is reported, the actual number has to be higher than that. Yeah. And I feel like the lowest hanging fruit they can do is, you know, rate limiting. Like I said, you go into a pawn shop with 1,000 Xboxes, mm-hmm. you know, maybe let him sell one and you take his ID and you check it out. So a lot of this is done by botting. So if someone is going to dump 1,000 keys all at once, you know, rate limit the account. It's like, yeah. You can sell one key a day. You know, they advertise themselves as a place for a regular Joes to go sell extra Steam keys they bought in a bundle that they're not going to use or something.
Yeah.
So why don't you check if your users fit that profile?
Mm-hmm.
And if they don't fit that profile, you rate limit them, you know, or you ban them or whatever. You know, you mm-hmm. like do a good job of anti-fraud security. None of this is complicated. None of it requires crazy technology. All of it is industry standard and used by other stores. And the only reason G2A isn't using it is because they make a lot of money off of fraud.
Yep, there we go. That, I was just about to say that, too. Now, one question for me. Something tells me this is a very stupid question, but I just want to ask this, Lars.
Go for it.
Has there been any ways of tracking the people who are selling or who are buying these fraudulent credit cards and basically, again, doing the bot and going like that way? Like, is there any way of tracking these people, or are they just like too good, or it's just not capable at the time?
You know, I mean, I think it's going to be just a mix of script kiddies who mm-hmm. leave just a ridiculous digital paper trail,
yeah.
all the way up to like your super expert, like,
mm-hmm.
you know, stereotypical Russian Bitcoin hackers who, you know, are just in their digital fortresses and you'll never find them. I think you probably could. I mean, you could have some investigative journalists go out and like
mm-hmm.
figure out what the whole dark underbelly looks like, but that's still kind of like hacking at the branches of the problem rather than the root. The root of the problem is that there's an incentive to do this. And some people have pointed out rightly that, you know, we as developers need to do a better job of protecting against fraud. And that's true. It's kind of blaming the victim, but, you know, it's mm-hmm. if we were more careful with keys, you know, then there would be less victimization. You know, that's kind of mm-hmm. like that's kind of like telling people that, yeah, anyway, yeah. But, and it's a little beside the point, but there's things Steam could do. They could work on their API, but G2A is the real enabler, mm-hmm. you know, and stores like them are the real enabler. You know, obviously, I don't think they're going to be willing to reform much except in a token kind of superficial way. So obviously, yeah. we're going to have to find ways to kind of cut off their air supply ourselves. But the moral authority on them is to cut out the incentive for this. And because they do not only not really do a good job of checking for fraud, but make money on it coming and going.
Yeah.
They really, like, Steam key scamming was always a problem. People pretending to be total bisquick at gmail.com and yeah. ask for 10 free keys for their friends. You know, that was always a problem, but the volume has increased massively in the last year. Indie Game Stand wrote an article detailing the increase in the volume of the fraud, and that's because now there's a marketplace. Now it's a liquid good.
Yeah.
Now you can steal stuff and go and fence it immediately. If you don't have a fence, you don't have theft. You mm-hmm. know, not as a profession, at least.
Yeah. And I agree with you with that, Lars. With the rise, again, G2A hasn't been around, I think, for like a really long time. It's only been like a few years since they first popped onto the scene.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I actually got some really good comments on my article, like understanding where they came from. I think they originally started as like a Polish, just, you know, tiny little store.
Mm-hmm.
And they originally served the Polish market and the Eastern European market because, you know, the mm-hmm. purchasing power is much lower there. And there's always problems with it. I can't set more than one price for euros. So I have to set German prices in like Estonia or whatever. I don't know if they use the euro there, but some Eastern European country does use the euro, and like they make much less, so they can't afford full price. So they would use these sites. Now, what happened a couple of years ago is they all got bought up by Asian investors and they all moved to like Hong Kong and stuff. where they're not really under the thumb of the US, the UK, the EU, any of those traditional regulatory authorities. And since they've kind of gone, you know, outside of the those regulatory bodies, they've kind of pushed really hard on this shady business, and then they've aggressively courted all these YouTubers and Twitch streamers. I think PewDiePie is sponsored by G2A, at least he used to be. He might still be. And, you know, it's just all over the fact, and that's how they buy their legitimacy. Every regular gamer, you know, just thinks it's just a place to get cheap keys. And as I put in my article, the really insidious thing is because you get a real Steam key, it's not like piracy where you get the game for free, but you know you're doing something bad or at least risky. You know, you feel like, hey, this is just as good as the real thing. I'm paying money for it like a good citizen, and I'm getting a great deal. So they compete with you on every currency, on time, on pain in the butt, on money, and on integrity, as I call them. And so they undercut you on everything, but only because they're lying to you.
And again, like we had, there are a lot of digital stores up these days beyond just GOG, Steam, and Humble Bundle. I know Green Man Gaming has been gaining traction. And as you said, Lars, the difference between piracy and what's going on in this case is the fact that as a consumer, you don't know essentially where this key come from. As the old saying goes, you're not seeing how the sausage is being made.
Yeah, they essentially fell off the back of a truck.
Yeah.
You know, someone's out that inventory.
But the problem is, again, when you're basically, as you said, just like buying legitimacy, the consumer doesn't know what's going on with G2A. They don't know where these keys came from. Again, they think it's the same thing as going to Steam or Humble Bundle or GOG. I put my money in, I get a key, and, you know, it's 100% legitimate. Because, you know, I'm not going to like a site like Pirate Bay. I'm not, you know, torrenting your game. I'm, you know, I'm being a good consumer.
Right.
But that's not necessarily the case.
And it is really ingenious. You know, by making people pay a small amount of money, they feel like I've seen people argue with me that it's like, you're just a greedy developer who wants to take away this great deal for us. I'm like, wait, I'm greedy because I'm telling you go pirate my game instead of buying it from G2A. I'm greedy because I'm telling you to spend less money. And it shows you that it's like, you know, that really great deal like makes you feel good. And it makes you feel like you've got a great deal, but also makes you feel like I did the right thing. And I did the right thing for such a low cost, you know, that, I mean, but it's based on a lie. And also they're going to, you know, your key will get revoked and then you'll be left with nothing. And, oh, by the way, why don't you pay for GTA Shield? And anyway, so I feel like it's, they've bought this legitimacy, and I feel like, you know, we need to put pressure on people like PewDiePie and the other YouTubers, who have given them this legitimacy to take it away from them, you know, because I think that before they were just advertised everywhere, you know, there was a little sense of, you know, it's like going to like, I don't know, like cheap MP3s.xyr and you can pay $1.50, you know, to get 700 MP3s. You're like, this feels a little weird, but if cheap MP3s.xyr is advertised by Michael Jordan and, you know, and all your favorite celebrities, then it's like, oh, yeah, that's where I get all my cheap MP3s.
Definitely. Now, I want to bring James in the conversation. Again, James, you've been mainly a console gamer. You don't do too much with the PC side, at least not yet. As someone who has been, again, console gamer, and you're hearing these kind of discussions, do you have any questions or thoughts on this matter?
I think that a lot of I actually encourage, I'm going to speak to the console gaming people as well, who would, I think, honestly hear this podcast and be like, oh, well, this doesn't concern me. It does concern you. It concerns you in a big way, considering the fact that, like, what's the next step? Because if this is what's happening, and anybody who is a gamer should know, what happens to PC is just right down the road from happening to the console market. And I think that's something that we need to definitely keep an eye out and nip it in the butt right now while it's on PC, you know what I mean? And make sure that it doesn't happen on console. Now, I honestly do think that, like, Sony and Microsoft are a little more, they have a little bit more say over what's going on because, you know, their games are going through them and stuff like that. So, you know, you're not really getting a lot of resell on that, but, you know, they're always going to make their money before it ever gets to that point. But, you know, on the developer end, like, guys, you guys are listening to the people that are making your games. And they're telling you, yo, these people are stealing from us. Stop supporting them. Like, it's, and that's something that we, I think as console gamers don't fully realize that it can easily happen to us.
What I think is the real danger is Sony and Microsoft and Nintendo are going to see this as like, this is why we need to just lock down the systems even more. Mm-hmm. This is why we need more DRM. Yeah. This is why we can't let this is why we need to make developers pay for all their keys, you know, like make them pay full price for their press keys, you know, so that there's no risk to us, you know, no matter what happens to them and all kinds of crazy stuff like that. So, you know, I mean, we talk about all this and all the problems with keys and stuff, but it's like Steam keys and being able to like give them to press and being able to like sell them on our own stores and stuff. It's like, it was a really good thing. Yeah. You know, it has a lot of flexibility, super convenient, super easy to, you know, do stuff like it, you know, and then I even support, you know, right of first sale used games. Some people don't. I do. I see that as a good thing, you know, and, you know, the console, you know, traditional console viewpoint is, you know, is try to like lock down the secondary market entirely and stuff. So I feel like a lot of the things I see are good, that could come to console might not if this kind of scandal is allowed to run rampant because those console holders are so, you know, just so financially and conservative that I think they would be afraid to take the risk in opening up more. I think their intention would just be to lock everything down, more region restrictions, more hardware DRM, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. And I would say another consequence would be it would also keep them from porting more games of the PC and expanding that reach, which has been very big for a lot of developers getting the option to sell their console games on the PC. Now,
for gamers too, who like what a lot of people don't realize is that there are console gamers that love PC games and just either, you know, they were only able to buy so many, you know what I mean? Due to whatnot. To take that away is going to be it's a step backwards. It's a step in the wrong direction.
Yeah. And the thing is that console developers and console publishers have been for years against porting their games to the PC. They, of course, made the classic claim that, you know, I port my games, it's going to be pirated. Why should I risk that when I have this closed system on my PlayStation or Xbox? Excuse me. That, you know, I can guarantee that people are going to buy this game at $60. I don't have to worry about pirate copies. I don't need to worry about someone stealing a key. I don't have to worry about DRM, etc., etc. And that's what kept a lot of console games off of the PC side of things. Now, over like the last 4 or 5 years, we've been seeing that change. A lot of big name console games have been making the move to PC. I mean, hell, the Dark Souls series is a really good example of that. It doesn't matter how great Dark Souls is, 10 years ago, it probably would have never found its way on the PC. But thanks to Steam, and again, building that level of legitimacy with the digital market, it's been easing a lot of console developers and console publishers' minds on that front. But when you have issues like this, like, if word gets out, this is becoming more and more of an issue, and, you know, you port your game to the PC and you worry about this, how many console games are going to take that risk? It's just going to kill that side of things.
Right, you know, and you had Ubisoft.
Mm-hmm.
This was mentioned in the G2A Den of Thieves video by Level Cap Gaming. You know, they had a bunch of keys scammed from them, and so the problem is, the really insidious thing with G2A is that when there's a problem, when a key doesn't work, or if there's any issue, this is another reason fraud is underreported, is the player tends to blame the publisher or the developer. Yeah. They're like, I had this key, I bought it from some site, I bought it from the internet. You know, I bought the game, and it doesn't work, and it's your fault. You know? So G2A gets to come out smelling like a rose while you know, developers and publishers have to deal with all the negative feedback. And then, you know, someone like Ubisoft, who's, you know, has very different principles from me, is like, you know, screw this. Everything is getting locked down with Uplay, like even worse than before.
Yeah.
You know, we're going to stick that DRM right in your butt. You know, that's what I think is ultimately going to happen here. Not to mention, of course, the just very obvious fact of just money being taken out of developer and publisher's pockets so that, you know, they just have, you just get crappier games because just the market shrinks.
Exactly. And when these games have been locked down, it has caused a lot of problems. I know back in the day when Uplay was first revealed that a lot of those first, I guess, first Uplay generation titles did horrible on the market due to how stringent the DRM was. Right. And again, this is something that, as a gamer, you don't necessarily think about this, but for a developer who's, you know, hoping and planning their game will sell so they can keep producing games and have an income, you know, this is just something that's completely out of your control, yet it's still just, you know, cutting you off at the kneecaps, essentially, from your audience.
Yeah, I'm going to go on the record just to be super clear. I hate DRM and I don't support it. But what always tends to happen in these situations is it's just like a warning of what is going to happen is these companies, usually from pressure from the top, from the suits, who don't take the long view, you know, they always go for the command and control option when they get spooked. And it and so if we don't cut off the oxygen to sites like G2A and or get them to reform, you're going to see these blowback reactions. It probably won't actually be the right solution for those developers and publishers. Probably won't make them more money, probably won't necessarily accomplish what they want, but they'll do it because that's what they do when they get spooked, and it'll be bad for gamers.
Yep. And I think a really good point that I just want to elaborate on that you just said a few things ago, Lars, that the vast majority of consumers just aren't educated on these issues. And the reason is simple. We don't take the time to explain this stuff. I mean,
it's complicated.
Yeah. I mean, that's one of the things I found as a goal with Game Wisdom is to sort of bring these topics, bring these discussions to the front. Because again, I mean, I can go back to my example with game preservation. There's a lot of consumers who really don't give a crap about preserving video games, but it's still a very important topic that people don't tend to know about. And this is another really good example of that. Again, like, speaking with James, again, as a console gamer, this is something that the console market doesn't know about. I bet chances are for a lot of console gamers listening, they're just going, you know, this doesn't bother me. How is this going to come back to bite me? But as we were saying, if something affects one part of the game industry, chances are it's going to affect all parts of it eventually.
Right.
Yeah, this has definitely been a fascinating conversation. And again, it's a topic that there hasn't really been too much discussion about, at least not as of the time of this recording. I'm pretty much sure, like, with all these issues of the game industry, as the months go on, especially by the end of 2016, I'm sure there'll be more discussions and more talks about things. To wrap up this section and this cast, Lars, I guess to sort of surmise everything that we've talked about, I know you've mentioned this already multiple times in the cast, but to, I guess, tie a ribbon on this discussion, what do you think would be the solution, again, just to, like, frame this up for the end?
Oh, to G2A and stuff like that?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you got to come at it from two sides. First, you got to assume that they're not going to reform themselves. So we as developers, first of all, have to not let ourselves become victims. So we have to be much more careful with our keys. I don't think we need to do that in a way that's anti-consumer. One way you could do it is just never go on discount, you know, never give out keys. I think that's the wrong way. I think you should just make sure that you don't roll your own store, just hook up Stripe and hope for the best. That always ends in tears. I would recommend going through someone who has been there and knows how to deal with fraud, like Humble or Itch. You can get, you know, you can keep most of the money if you sell through their widgets, and then they will take care of, you know, not just the fraud checking, but also the taxes. And then you can distribute Steam keys in a safe way. And I think if you do that, that'll cut off a lot of the fraudulent sales to G2A. Second, use sites like Distribute to verify and validate people who are pretending to be total Bisquick or, you know, PewDiePie and trying to steal keys from you. So that's one thing. And then we need to, here's where awareness and attention can actually do some good. We need to just get in the face of YouTubers like PewDiePie and all the rest who are sponsored, who are making all this money off of these sponsorships, and just make them aware that where their money is coming from. We need to like not do it in like a real witch hunt mob way and be like, you awful person, you know, how dare you, you know, you need to like, you need to divest now before we like throw blood on your fur coat or whatever. But what we need to do is it's like, hey, did you know this was a problem? You know, and if you do that, I think a lot of them will be more principled than we gave them credit for, and you know, and cancel their sponsorships, even though it costs them something. I think a lot of them would instantly do that. And, you know, if that starts to gain momentum, then others will follow. I mean, I think some of them really are just in it for the money and do know, you know, what's going on, or at least are choosing to look the other way. And I don't want to start a witch hunt, though. So I think just kind of putting positive pressure on them to just realize that this is, yeah, this is what's happening and it's undeniable, you know. And then on that note, you know, there's a lot of people who are still arguing with me who don't believe me. You know, they're just so attracted by those cheap keys. Even when I tell them, go out and get it for free, go pirate it, dude. They're still not convinced, and they're still resentful that I'm saying it's bad. You know, I think we need like an actual investigative journalist to go in and just really confirm all this stuff. I mean, we've laid out a lot of data, especially in the videos and articles I've referenced. You know, there's a lot of data that really just, you know, shows, yeah, this is happening. But I think an investigative journalist could really just put the nail in the coffin by just putting it out in undeniable black and white, take every complaint that's been brought up, every counter argument, and just show, here is the data that solidly refutes it in a way that's a little more professional than what I'm able to muster. And so it's just those three things, you know, keep yourself from being a victim as a developer, cut off their legitimacy by going after the people they sponsor and getting them to drop the sponsorships. And then third, get journalists to really help us with the fact checking so that we can have more ammunition to, you know, convince people who aren't convinced, you know, with the evidence we've presented already.
Yeah. And I also think that we do need to do more with educating the consumers on these matters. But as you said, Lars, it can be very tricky. Like, we talked about this already in the cast regarding that mentality that when you're spending money, it's considered legitimate.
Yeah, it's like the vast majority of consumers are going to be really hard to reach because, like, I mean, who really is the person who's on Reddit? Who's the person that's reading our blogs? You know, so, and what we're competing against is every 13-year-old seeing that G2A logo on PewDiePie's place. So I think we need to keep talking about this and get the conversation going. We need to get as much attention as they're getting through sponsorships by taking our voices and amplifying them. And so this podcast is a great step towards that. You know, getting YouTubers to talk about it is a great step. You know, getting people to write articles is a great step. Just tell your friends, you know, just let people know what's happening. You know, it's an uphill battle, but I think we can do it. And I'm really glad that you guys are, you know, are helping to give a voice to this issue.
Yeah. Thanks for the comment, Lars. And again, that's one of the things I love about doing this with Game Wisdom is the fact that there really aren't too many places that dig into these kinds of topics with game design and the industry. Like when I did my talk on game preservation, and even just talking more about the mechanics and the high-level thinking of what goes into game design, these aren't topics that most people are discussing on a daily basis. But they are still very important for the state of the game industry, and especially for people entering it or interested in it for the future.
Yeah, it's kind of like NPR for game design. I like it.
Nice. We need to get that on a card, James. Maybe that's another good tagline.
Yeah.
All right. But again, we could sit here and talk for who knows how long. And this is one of those topics that we're not going to solve today. Like, this is not something that's going to be over right now. I'm sure, as I said a few minutes ago, we're going to keep talking about this and going to keep hearing more issues of this in the coming months. Hopefully, the next time we hear about this will be more good news, at least on the developer side of things. But this is definitely a serious issue. For those of you listening to the cast, be sure to, of course, make sure you know where you're actually getting your keys from. And again, just educate yourself on these matters. All right. My throat is starting to dry up, so I think it's time to end things. Once again, I'm going to cough. All right. There you go. So we're going to wrap things up for this episode of the Perceptive Podcast. Lars, it was a pleasure hanging out with you this afternoon. Like I said, I would love to have you back on for a talk regarding more on the fur sale things, because that is another big topic that I know has been given too much discussion about.
Thanks very much for having me.
Yep. And definitely let me know when you have more news and more information regarding Defender's Quest 2. I would love to check that out when the time comes.
Cool.
All right. James, again, I know you haven't had too much to say on these casts, but...
Yeah, fine. I'm learning a lot. Definitely learning.
But I think this was a very fascinating topic. Again, especially for someone who has stuck mostly to console games. This is something that I know you haven't been exposed to too much.
Definitely.
Awesome. So, for those of you listening to the cast, we're going to end things here. As always, if you would like to support Game Wisdom, we have a lot of options available. If you'd like to be a podcast guest or contribute a piece of the site, you can find information and links under Submissions Wanted on the front page. For podcast guests, we are looking for anyone. If you're a student, enthusiast, developer, as long as you're interested in talking about game design industry, we'd love to have you on. To support our ongoing Patreon campaign to get the monthly funding I need to keep Game Wisdom going, you can find me on Patreon under Game Wisdom or by clicking the Patreon banner on the front page. Your donations not only can help to keep the site going, but will allow me to add more content for you in the future. And speaking of that, a new reward I've added is a special shout out to people who pledge at least $15 or more to the cast. So, for these casts on for the going future, if you support that amount, I'd like to give a special shout to those contributors who are helping to keep Game Wisdom going. So I'd like to thank Danny Rondas and King Isaac Lynx. I know King Isaac is Tim, who's been a frequent podcast guest, so thank you for your support. If you're listening to this cast and would like to get a shout as well, be sure to check out the Patreon campaign, as well as the new digital CD option, where you'll get a digital CD of the month's cast, including a special bonus commentary track from me. Last but not least, you can follow me on Twitch and Twitter under GW Bicer to get the latest updates when content goes live, and you can check out all my daily video content on the Game Wisdom YouTube channel, where you'll find Let's Plays, game examinations, and more. So, with all that said, thanks so much for tuning into this episode of the Perceptive Podcast. Have a great rest of the week, and we will talk to you again next time. Take care, everybody.